Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If your summer travel plans will take you to London or Manchester or Glasgow, you're probably not worried about communicating. But like Darwin's Galapagos finches, the language we all know as English has been evolving in slightly different ways on the different sides of the Atlantic to serve the needs of the U.S. and the U.K. In the absence of a dictionary to help you translate American English into British English, you might use Erin Moore's book as a guide. She's an American raised by Anglophile parents who discovered when she moved to London how many words belong in only one place, which is why Americans have to look up words like whinge when we read Harry Potter books, and British teenagers do not call each other dude. Another category of words has one meaning in the U.S. and another in the U.K., including sorry, quite, jumper, and biscuit. As we'll discuss this hour, our linguistic tendencies are actually an ideal lens through which to understand the very different cultures of the English-speaking world. The new book by author Erin Moore is called That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. Erin, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You write that England and the U.S. exist in mutual admiration and antagonism. How does that manifest itself?
Well, it's really interesting, actually, because we've been going back and forth for many years. So when America was founded, Americans started to travel back to the U.K., way back when, the British thought that American English was really charming. They thought, oh, it's just that little bit archaic. It's the way we used to talk, but there are some new words. It's so interesting. And of course, then they were the overdog country and we were the underdogs. But things have changed. And now America is this huge, brash country where all of our cultural products are aggressively exported. And I think that the British, as many other nationalities feel, may be a little bit put upon by them. It's not something they can opt out of. They're sort of surrounded. And so there's little love for an Americanism now.
Well, it's understandable that British people would feel more right to declare what is proper English and what isn't. But as you point out in the book, neither country is still speaking like our ancestors did in the 18th century.
That's right. It's really, I think that the temptation for some people, even Americans will say this about American and British English, that British English is the parent and American English is the child. That's not actually true. It's more of a sibling situation.
One thing you found hard to take when you first moved was having your own assumptions about Americans and American culture challenged. What did you realize about the extent to which your Americanness had shaped your personality?
Oh, that was a really interesting thing for me when I moved to England, because I had been living in New York for 10 years. I had been a book editor at Penguin. I had specialized in bringing British books to America for the American market. So I'd spent a lot of time with British people. I'd also married into a large extended British-American family. I felt that I knew where I was, when it came to British English. But when I moved and started working from the British office of Penguin, in London, it was a revelation to me just how foreign I really was. I had never realized how American I was in every mannerism, in every attitude, in everything that I said. And I really was surprised by what a gap there was between me and other people, how hard it was to communicate.
The thing that I've always found fascinating is the irony that moving to another place that you really love means that you have gone there to embrace what can be found, and yet the natives are always going to associate you with your country of origin.
That is so true. Particularly in the Bush years when I first moved to London, I would be called on many times by people, to sort of account for what was going on in American politics. And it was really interesting because for me, I really couldn't do that. It wasn't something for me that I wanted to necessarily defend, but they seemed to expect me to because I was American. And things got a little bit easier when Obama came into office. But as an American, you are seen as representative of your country. And in many ways, I really, really am. But in some ways, there are things that are going on in America that I'm just not up on. And if people ask me a question about it, they'll be disappointed.
Let's talk about some words and phrases now. When Americans say sorry, we typically mean sorry. I regret what just happened. This word is vastly more complicated in England.
Oh, it is so much more complicated. And sorry, depending on how you say it, can have about a dozen meanings in England. And it really takes a long time to parse those meanings. If you go over there as an American, you might think that they're apologizing to you all the time. But actually, sorry, it can mean get out of my way. It can be about giving you your space. It could mean a lot of different things. One of the really fascinating things that I found out when I moved there and was researching this book, I read this wonderful book that I'd recommend to everyone called Kate Fox's Watching the English. She's an anthropologist who studied her own people for years and wrote this wonderful doorstopper of a book where she really explains the English to themselves. And it's one of my favorite things that I read during my research. In it, she describes the concept of negative versus positive politeness. And what sorry really comes down to, the reason the English have so many different words for sorry is that sorry is a politeness word that they use that sort of typifies their version, which is negative politeness. So what negative politeness means is that being polite to other people in England means giving them their space. It means not encroaching on them. It means, you know, if you do, you sort of say sorry. For Americans, what politeness means, our concept is more positive politeness. For Americans, it's about including other people. It's about reaching out to other people, going to them, pulling them in, telling them your life story. It's completely opposite. So that's why a British friend told me that British politeness has more in common with the version that they have in Japan than with what Americans think of as politeness.
One example that you give is if you got onto a city bus and saw someone weeping, in Britain, you would like leave that person alone. Like, I don't know what the problem is, but they clearly want to be left alone. And in the U.S., we would rush up to that person and say, are you all right? Is there anything I can do?
Yes, I've been called on this by some British people when I've said this, because they say it's a city thing. And that could very well be true, because I spend most of my time in London. And in London, you would never approach that person. It would be the wrong thing to do. But actually, I lived in New York for many years, and I saw people approach that person in New York, and I never see it in London. I also see people in New York. I'm here this week. See people talk to each other on public transportation. See people exchange ideas about books they're reading, things like that. I've been riding the tube in London for years and years and never seen that happen once. So, yes, it could be a city thing, but I think that the British, they are more inclined to leave that person to themselves. And I think that is because that's what they personally would want. Whereas I, you know, I'm from the South. I'm very warm. If I was very upset in public and somebody reached out to me that way, I would appreciate it.
Okay, Erin, if somebody told me I was quite clever, I think I would take that as a lovely compliment. But it wouldn't be a lovely compliment if it came from a British friend.
Oh, it would be a double negative. That is such a funny one. Yes, that you've picked up on two things that are different about British English. First of all, if an American says, I quite like your book or I quite like your dress, we mean we really like it. Quite is an intensifier. Whereas for English people, quite is a sort of a, if you say you quite like something, it means you really don't like it very much. You're sort of holding back, or you're damning something with faint praise. If I say to a British person, I love that book, they might say, oh, I quite liked it. And that means, it wasn't really for me. And clever is another one where, for Americans, if I call someone clever, it's a compliment. But for the British, that is sort of a pejorative term for smart. So if you said of someone, he's clever, you might mean he's smart, but you'd mean, but I don't really like him. If you wanted to say that someone was smart and you really liked the person, you'd say something like, he's terribly bright. You know, and, you know, he's terribly bright is something that you might say, but you wouldn't say clever, because clever has a connotation of deviousness in England.
I'm always interested in words that exist on both sides of the Atlantic, and we all know what they mean, but we just don't use them. For example, you'll hear English people saying something was brilliant, meaning that's awesome, which, of course, they would not say. And they know what yes. we mean when we say awesome, but they don't say it.
Exactly. No, it's true. It's differences in slang, but they're just words. And even having lived over there for 8 years, there are words like brilliant that I have not adopted because I feel incredibly silly saying them. I think you almost need a British accent to say them. And brilliant is also a bit of a class marking word. In my experience, it's sort of middle to upper class people who describe everything as brilliant, you know. And for me, it just doesn't fit me. So it's one of those words I have not adopted, but it is, yes, brilliant means awesome, but it's also a bit of a class marking word too.
Class is another thing that is defined in pretty different ways. And, you know, we all have different income levels and there are ways that you can sort of mark status that way. But we have mobility in this country and nothing gives us greater pride than to say I'm successful today and I came from nothing. Whereas in England, this is not going to do you any favors.
Oh, that is so true. In America, we love nothing more than a Horatio Alger story. We love nothing more if we have made it somehow. We love nothing more than telling the stories of how we came from nothing. And that can even be exaggerated. You know, I even find, you know, some of my friends exaggerate how poor they used to be or what they had to go through to get to where they are. Because that is a real asset in America because you're seen as being someone who, with a great work ethic, who's scrappy, who's determined. All these things are incredibly positive for Americans. But in England, it's not really true. In England, there's less class mobility. The other thing is that every time you open your mouth in England, oh, this only applies to British people, by the way. They don't apply the same standard to Americans because they can't tell where we come from or what our background is by the way we speak. But when English people talk to one another, they can tell by each other's accents and word choices all kinds of things about their family background, their schooling, you know, what kind of work they might do, what part of the country that they're from. It goes way beyond what an American can tell when we speak to another American. Americans can tell regionalisms, but not a lot more. Also, in America, we do have a class system, but it's more based on income, and it's much easier to change classes if your income level changes, for better and for worse, than it is in England.
And the worst thing a person can do if they are trying to appear to be upper class is to appear as if they're trying too hard. And you have this great story about people damning with faint praise the mother of Kate Middleton for having her kids sort of too well turned out when they showed up at school every day.
Oh, this is a really interesting story. I read this in a tabloid newspaper. There's a great culture of tabloid newspapers in England. And I'm not talking about newspapers that make things up. I'm talking about newspapers that they love to get kind of the dirt on things, kind of gossip papers. And I read an article when I was researching class. I read an article about in which many people were quoted who had known the Middletons when their kids were in school with their kids. And when Kate Middleton first started dating the prince, everyone was sort of looking down their noses about the idea that she was from the middle class, like the striving middle class. You know, she wasn't necessarily their idea of royalty. And so lots of people were interviewed about what the Middletons were really like. And this was an article that was about what it was like for kids to go to school with the Middleton children. And there was this very, I could recognize now, because I've been living in England for so long and my children are in school now, I could recognize now that she was being a snob. But I wouldn't necessarily have understood that 10 years ago.
We're speaking this hour with author Erin Moore. Her new book is called That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
Is our language a function, of our British cynicism, tolerance, resistance to false emotion, humour, and so on? Or do those qualities come extrinsically, from the language itself? It's a chicken and egg problem.
We're talking about chickens, we're talking about eggs.
Let me start a leveret here. There's language and there's speech. There's chess and there's a game of chess. Mark the difference for me. Mark it, please.
We've moved on to chess.
Imagine a piano keyboard. 88 keys, only 88, and yet hundreds of new melodies, new tunes, new harmonies are being composed upon hundreds of different keyboards every day in Dorset alone. Our language, Tiger, our language, hundreds of thousands of available words, trillions of legitimate new ideas, so that I can say the following sentence and be utterly sure that nobody has ever said it before in the history of human communication. Hold the newsreader's nose squarely, waiter, or friendly milk will countermand my trousers. Perfectly ordinary words, but never before put in that precise order. A unique child delivered of a unique mother.
You're listening to Think. You just heard Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie discussing language on the BBC comedy A Bit of Fry and Laurie. My guest for the hour is author Aaron Moore, author of the book That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. Aaron, I love that clip because it's completely ridiculous. Is language a common subject? Do English people love talking about language and the use of words and proper grammar as much as Americans these days seem to do?
I think they do. It of course depends on your context. When I was working at the Penguin offices in London, of course, it's all we ever talked about. And my friends talk about that quite a lot. Definitely, it seems as if all of that is a preoccupation on both sides of the pond.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Emily in Plano. Hi, Emily.
Hi, I'm a first-time caller. I've always wanted to say that.
Welcome.
This is a great show. And, I really appreciated a lot of what Aaron had to say. One thing that's different, though, she said that you in the U.S. people can't necessarily determine someone's class. There's a difference, and I'm saying a lot, which my parents kill me for, even though I'm a grown woman. In the African-American culture, where I was raised in the African Americans, I grew up in the suburb of the city, and my parents were upper middle class. We spoke very well as African Americans, and when we would go to the city and be around city African Americans that did speak well, it was very common for our parents to kind of look down on other blacks, and the way someone speaks could really easily, quickly determine what class they were in. That was definitely a way of determining someone, unfortunately, regardless of money, just determined how you're being perceived or what kind of class you're coming from, what kind of person you are.
That's a really interesting point, Emily. Thanks so much for your call. Do you want to respond to that, Aaron?
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I've observed similar things. My family was from Savannah back when, and the differences in accents in that city, just some people that we knew would say ain't and some people wouldn't. And there were sort of informal ways of speaking that some people had and some people didn't. And there was sort of it was class marking. But what's fascinating about, so in England, all of these things in your own country, you're really attuned. In your own community, you're really attuned to these things. But someone from outside of it doesn't necessarily get it. So when I moved to London, I couldn't tell what people's accents said about them. And in a lot of ways, I still can't. I can't necessarily recognize the regional accents. I now get the class things. But when I first moved, I didn't at all. So it's really fascinating that when we are on our own patch, you know, when you are in your own community, you are attuned to every little thing people say. But if you went to England, all of the different British accents of all the different classes and all the different regions are more like each other than they're like yours. So you really feel flat-footed. You can't really tell, as an American moving over there, you can't really tell anything about them, whereas on your own patch, you're the expert.
Both Americans and British people go to rather ridiculous lengths to avoid using the word toilet. How did we end up with different euphemisms for the room that contains a toilet?
Oh, this is a funny one. So I found this wonderful old word. It was a word that MFK Fisher used in an essay collection that she wrote. This word is scunner. The idea of a scunner is something that you've taken against, something that really puts you off or upsets you. There are people take scunners against different things. For example, a lot of people don't like the sound of the word moist. Moist is a word that lots and lots of people have a scunner against. And there is even a Facebook group about it. There's several pieces of fairly serious journalism devoted to this, which, you know, I thought was very funny. But this idea that there are certain words that people really don't like, often it's a very individual thing. I have a scunner against the word succulent. I just hate that word. I don't know why I hate it so much, but I always have. And it just gives me the heebie-jeebies. But I think that it's very rare that one of these words kind of crosses cultures as a shared scunner. But a lot of people on both sides of the Atlantic do not like to use the word toilet. When I was growing up, my mother would always say, "Oh, I'm going to wash my hands," or that sort of thing. It was sort of too descriptive of what went on in the bathroom in a way. It was too specific. I was raised to just not be so specific about you know, we never use that word, and a lot of Americans don't, or they would say it's not their favorite word for that, you know, that room of their house. They would say bathroom or they would say restroom. And the English way of speaking, like I said, certain things that people will say will classify them to other English people. And one of these words is toilet. Toilet is considered a very déclassé word. It's a word that that sort of middle and upper class people sort of shrink from. They don't want to use it. It's a word that will get you judged if you use it. And I'm not talking about being an American in England, because Americans can opt out of all this, luckily, because you know, I could care less. I could care less what class someone is or how they speak. I'd be friends with anyone, and my friends cross all boundaries, mm-hmm. In England. But there are a lot of snobs out there. And to those snobby people, saying the word toilet instantly gets you classified below where they would have you be.
But they write it on the doors of all of their what we call restrooms. Why don't they use a different word?
That's totally fascinating to me. I don't know the answer to that. And I think that the fact that the word toilet is up in 5,000-point type in front of every public convenience that you'd ever go to, I think that just makes it even more of a déclassé word. Somehow the ubiquity of it on public conveniences just makes it even more of a word that certain people just won't say. There was a wonderful book that Sarah Lyle, who she still writes for the New York Times, she wrote about marrying into a British family, moving to London. And she wrote extensively about the class marking words that she learned not to use. And someone, she quoted someone as saying they would rather their children use the F word in public than toilet.
Hmm. Another thing it turns out we have in common is a robust love of swearing. And we may choose favorite expressions and different words, and we will not use any of them today on
no.
the radio. But what do you think that's about? Do we like swearing more than other English-speaking countries, or do we literally in the English-speaking world like swearing more than people who use other languages?
Well, I don't know. I think that Americans, to my ears, swear a bit less than the British, if anything. And I love the sort of Ned Flanders school of swearing that many Americans subscribe to.
Jiminy Christmas.
Yes, exactly. I think that Americans can be and in my opinion, this is a good thing, a bit puritanical about swearing. We don't necessarily let fly, you know, in polite company with these words. There's a little more swearing in my experience, a little more swearing going on casually in England or what sounds more, you know, sounds swearier than what goes on here. But American swears, they're ubiquitous in England because all of our films and all of our books and our culture is everywhere there. So you hear a lot of American swears that are sort of they've crossed cultures, they've crossed over. But then there are a lot of swears that are really still just British swears. And I found it fascinating to research the history of some of those swears. A word that I think we can say on the radio, which is, it starts with a B. Can we say that
yes.
word on the radio?
Yes.
So the British often will say bloody. And bloody, it just sounds very, very English. When I'm saying it, it just doesn't sound right at all. You need a British accent to pull it off. You know, bloody this and bloody that. And bloody used to be one of the single nastiest swears you could use in Britain. And like all good swears, it's lost some of its impact through overuse. But it's still a word you really wouldn't want to say in front of your grandmother. And it's something that's considered quite rude. And in America, I think that we don't really understand that. So when we set out to swear like an English person, that's probably the first one we pull out.
My teenage children now use the word ginger to describe people with red hair, but they use it in sort of a silly way because they grew up reading Harry Potter books and different things.
Yes.
But I have to, I mean, red hair is beautiful. Why is it such a liability in the UK?
Well, this I found this pretty strange, really, because when I was growing up, I always envied people with red hair. And as soon as I was old enough to do this, I went out and dyed my hair red. I've stopped doing that now because it's way too high maintenance, but I always wanted red hair. And I know that a lot of Americans feel the same way. You know, actresses like Christina Hendricks with her gorgeous red hair, they send all of us running to the beauty salon. And it's considered, although I know that children on the playground can be a bit mean about what makes other children different, I think that overall in our country, to have red hair is considered beautiful. But in England, this, you know, this making fun of people with red hair goes way beyond the playground. There have been actual incidents of hate crime toward people with red hair, and they're called ginger, and that's really considered pejorative. You would not, people call redheaded people gingers, and it's really a not very nice thing to do. In America, for your kids to say it doesn't hurt anyone's feelings because it doesn't have the teeth that it has in England, but it's just not something, if you're being sensitive, you wouldn't use it there. And I think that what redheadedness in England is seen a little differently because there's this ancient conflict with the Celtic neighbors, you know, with Scotland and Ireland, that although it's not on necessarily right on the surface these days, it's never far beneath the surface. And historically, those countries, and genetically, those countries produce a lot more redheads, probably seven times the number that Britain does. And so even though someone today might not necessarily think they're evoking an old prejudice when they use the term ginger, that is exactly what they're doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Jay on the line in Pilot Point. Hi, Jay.
Hi. Good afternoon. Interesting conversation.
Thanks.
I'm not sure if I'm hearing it correctly, but I keep hearing it often when I watch British contemporary shows or shows in a contemporary time. It seems like people are always taking the articles out of things that they're doing, like go vacation or went to hospital. I never hear the hospital or going on a vacation, and I'm not sure if that's something recent or am I just hearing it wrong.
Oh, on holiday and in hospital. What do you know about that, Aaron?
You are completely right. That is something that the British do, and it strikes my ear as wrong every time I hear it. In hospital, I say on vacation now, but I think I always did, but in hospital is something I just always want to add a the. It really drives me crazy. And I'm sorry, but I can't remember why that is. I looked it up once and I found out But it wasn't a very interesting reason, and it just slipped my... I didn't put it in the book. I wanted to put that in the book, but I had 100 different words that I was researching to come down to 30 of the most interesting ones. And unfortunately, although that is a phenomenon that is in effect and one that kind of drives me crazy when I hear it, and I did research it, in the end, the answer, I'm afraid the answer just wasn't so compelling that it stuck in my mind. But you're absolutely right. They do that. And it's just in the same way as they say maths instead of math.
That's just too hard to say.
When they're talking about the subject math, it's very hard to say. But they, instead of plural, the plural sports, they say sport to refer to all sports. So it feels really contrarian to the American ear. All this just sounds bizarre, doesn't it?
Do you have a position now on Americans who have decided they love these little words and they're throwing out words like twee and they're saying when I was at university? Like, to me, it's so charming when a person with a British background says I'm on holiday, or, you know, I purchased a bespoke shirt. It sounds a little affected, I think, when Americans with no connection to that culture begin to toss these words into their vocabulary.
I could not agree with you more. I really couldn't agree with you more. I think that I'm okay with other people doing it. I can live and let live where this is concerned. But for me, I feel that the best thing you can do linguistically is be true to yourself. And if there's a word that the British have that American English does not have the equivalent word, that's when I'll adopt the word. But if there's a perfectly good American English word to use, then I have pretty much stuck to that, only because I just feel like you end up sounding like a student on their junior year abroad when you do that. Or people all made fun of Madonna for a reason.
Right.
I agree with you, it sounds a little affected. But what's funny is that we should say that Britishisms sound affected. I think what's interesting is that when British people use Americanisms, their criticism of it is that it sounds sloppy, whereas we think it sounds affected. And that indicates overall our view of each other's countries, doesn't it?
We need some national therapy here, clearly. We're speaking with Erin Moore, author of the new book, That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. You can join the conversation. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning, with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are now being accepted for the program beginning April 6th. smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Erin Moore, author of the new book, That's Not English, Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Erin, our producer Stephen Becker just brought this up, that there's a subject-verb agreement difference in terms of how we use certain things. You might say, Manchester United are playing Thursday, Coldplay are performing at the arena, the family are gathering for a picnic. What's that all about?
Yes, that is a difference. That's one of those things that British people habitually do that sounds so wrong to American ears. And it's one of the reasons why I never could have been a book editor in Britain, because all of there are so many things like that. That's just one of many little differences that are... they just are what they are, and you have to learn them. If you were going to, for example, edit a book in British English, I was making a living for a while Americanizing books from British publishers, and I could do it because I just had an ear for what sounded right, what sounded American, and that's why they hired me. But I could never go the other way, because all of these things are, yes, I always notice them. There's never a moment when somebody says something like that that my ears don't just prick up at what sounds to me like something wrong, when actually in their country it's perfectly correct.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Ashley's online in Dallas. Excuse me. Hi, Ashley.
Hi. I'm loving this talk, and I think part of the reason is I actually had to spend a lot of time working in Europe before and encountered many of the issues you're bringing up. One of my favorite stories, though, is really about when I was doing an internship at BMW, and I worked with British and Germans, and they kept referring to the boot. And this was in the 90s, pre-Google, so we couldn't Google it, and it actually took us about 30 minutes to figure out what they were talking about. And
oh, no.
Yeah, it was the trunk of the
That's
car,
great.
Of course. But, I encountered so many times that I just didn't know what that word referred to. And I really didn't know until I worked over there that there were so many different words for the things that we use in America. It was a huge learning. So I can't imagine your learning curve either.
Right. And some words like that are fairly straightforward. You get them eventually by context, and thank goodness for Google, let me tell you. But there are some words that it's pretty straightforward, but the first time you hear it, it sounds so strange. I have a very good friend in England who's from Liverpool, and when she's not feeling well, she says she feels pants. And it's just such a funny thing to say, oh, I feel pants today. It sounds better when she says it. But in England, of course, pants actually means underwear. You wouldn't refer to the pants that you're wearing. You would have to say trousers. Otherwise, it's underwear. So it's you know, they think you mean underwear. So it's really interesting. There are words like that that very straightforwardly mean something else. But if you don't know it, you could get yourself in a little bit of trouble. For another example, I have a friend who had just started working for a British company, and she got the most enormous laugh from her colleagues by just saying, oh, I need to get my fanny into the gym, as in I haven't worked out for a while.
Right, right.
But you, if you read my book, you will find out what fanny means in England and realize just why they were rolling around on the floor in her office.
It does not mean bottom.
It does not.
Okay. What does the word okay tell us about the differences in our respective cultures?
Oh, well, so okay is a word that, for me, it's sort of emblematic of Americans being sort of consensus and approval seeking people, generally in our culture. The word okay, there are a lot of apocryphal stories out there, a lot of stories about how okay came to be, a word and such a ubiquitous word as it is now. But the real story that I was able to find in actually a book titled Okay, I'm forgetting the name of the author right now, but it's an interesting book, is that okay originated, it was a correction that was in a Boston newspaper, oh, I want to say at least 100 years ago. The whole story is in the book, but it was as an abbreviation for all correct, spelled OLLKORRECKT. So it was a joke that okay stood for all correct. And okay is a word that has become one of those sort of tagging words. You will say a sentence and say, okay, okay. And it's one of those consensus building types of words that Americans use a lot. And the English tend to use it a little bit less. There is a question tag that they use a lot, which is init, I-N-N-I-T. That's a class marking word, though. It's kind of a lower working lower class word to say in it at the end of a sentence. Again, I sound silly saying it, but it's a consensus sort of word, but it also can almost be an aggressive word, sort of I think this in it, as in you'd better agree with me or we're in trouble.
Like I dare you to challenge me, that sort of thing.
Pretty much, yeah. So anyway, interesting researching all these different question tags that exist in the two countries and what connotations they have.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Peter on the line in Dallas. Hi, Peter.
Yeah. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I'm a New Zealander who's lived in the U.S. for 40 years. Gave an interview in Barcelona not too long, a few years ago, and described New Zealanders as weird. Boy, were they insulted by that. It spawned an editorial that I got slammed.
Hmm.
And
oh, no.
Over here, it's not so bad. You know, keep Austin weird, for example.
Yeah, weird can be a charming word in the United States.
Yes,
yeah,
do you get tired of
knew that?
Well, I was going to ask you if you get tired of being asked if you're from Australia.
I'm sorry?
Do people do that? Do people ask you all the time if you're from Australia?
Yeah, they do, but I don't say Sikhs and I don't come from Sydney.
Yes.
I go dancing like the Brits do, not dancing like the Americans do.
Yes, yes. Yes, there is a kind of a nasal twang that the American accent can have.
What does weird mean? Is it the same in Britain, or is it more insulting there?
I don't get a sense that it's more insulting, but I don't hear it used quite as much.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have David on the line in Carrollton. Hi, David.
Hi. Hey, I had a question. I've noticed that a lot of the words that the British say, like Saul, they will have an R on the end of it, like Sar, or that they say
yes.
The name like Martha. It's Martha. And I was just curious
yes.
where that came from, and I can take your reply off the air.
Thanks for your call. That happened in New York, too. People would say, I'm drawing a picture.
Yes, that's a regionalism. That's something that people from certain parts of England do, and it's just, yes, it's just their accent. And just like we have some regional accents in America where people do the same thing, you know, and I grew up in Key West, for example, where no one ever puts a G on the end of an ING word. We're walking, we're talking, we're going somewhere. You just, the G does not exist. And it's the same with the added R. That's something that New Englanders do as well. And it's coming from, you know, I think it probably goes back to when Americans first started living in America and had brought sort of a certain regional accent here, and that added R has survived hundreds of years, and here we are.
Let's go to the phone now. We have Dave on the line in Plano. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Chris. I was a very interesting program, by the way.
Thank you.
I was listening to the lady earlier on talking about missing out the like on holiday and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, do you know why that's done?
Yeah, where I come from, which is North Yorkshire, uh-huh. which is not the upper class, but then I don't care about that. But
no.
We used to do a contraction of like the. So, for example, if you're saying I'm going to the pub, you'd say I'm going to pub, or going to store.
Was the common thing.
The other thing I do find living in the States, which I've lived in for about 30 years, I guess, but I'm still trying to protect my English accent.
Good for you.
they tend to, the thing that I find extremely irritating is most Americans pronounce height as height.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
You know, I sort of look at them and I say, excuse me? But anyway,
yes.
It's fun listening to your program. It's a good program.
Thanks for your call. And
Thank you
a great
so
explanation.
Much. Yeah, I so appreciate you calling because I really, once that caller mentioned it, I really did want to know and I didn't know. Thank you so much.
I was surprised to learn, Aaron, that the Christmas season in England can be any more over the top than the one in the U.S., but you chalk this up to the fact that they don't have, like, Halloween and Thanksgiving getting in the way, so the big sales can start in July.
Exactly. Now, I refer to Halloween and Thanksgiving as the speed bumps on the way to America's Christmas celebration, and thank goodness we have them, because otherwise you'd have a situation like they have in England where it's late July, early August, and you walk into a department store and you're just assaulted by all of this Christmas stuff and Christmas music and Christmas everything. And I always thought that America got started on this stuff early, but nothing compared to what they do there. Because Halloween is kind of, Halloween's beginning to be a little bit of a thing. My daughter was invited to a Halloween party this year for the first time, but it's not as big a thing, and it's definitely not a money-spending holiday as it is in America. I've heard Halloween is, I think it's the second highest spending holiday in America, but that's not true in England at all. And of course, Thanksgiving doesn't exist, so they are, as soon as midsummer has passed, they clear the buckets and the sun hats out of the stores and they replace it with ho 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 and all that jazz.
I had never heard the word crimbo before I read your book.
Oh my gosh, I had never heard the word crimbo before I moved to England, and it's such a funny word. It's a word that the English use for kind of the pagan side of Christmas, for lack of a better way to put it. You wouldn't say, oh, I'm spending Crimbo with my family, but you might refer to the office Crimbo party, mm-hmm. or, you know, what you doing for Crimbo kind of thing. It's a word, it's a sort of informal, disrespectful word for Christmas. It's almost like if our Xmas was something that we said out loud.
Yeah.
It's the same as that, but it's a spoken thing. And in the chapter in the book where I talk about Crimbo, what I get, each chapter in the book is about a different word, and each chapter opens the door to an aspect of our two cultures that is different and interesting. So the Crimbo chapter really opens the door to talk about panto, which is short for pantomime. It's a wonderful tradition that the British have. It's having a Christmas play where there is a sort of Lord of Misrule aspect to the whole thing. It is very pagan, very silly, huge fun, and there is a whole set of traditions that has evolved around this. My husband always jokes that the snobby way to talk about panto, which is a completely democratic sort of thing, is to point out to people that it came from the Commedia dell'arte tradition, which it actually did. But we don't have to, you know, it's panto is down home. Everybody does it. Everybody's into it. You can take your children. You can take your grandma. The first panto I ever saw, I was so lucky. I got to see a panto that was written by Stephen Fry, and it was Cinderella, based on the story of Cinderella, and the star of it was Sandy Toksvig, who is my absolute all-time favorite BBC quiz show host and wears a number of hats at the BBC. Anyway, I'll never forget it, but if... Really, that chapter of the book was a lot of fun to write because panto, the tradition of panto, does not exist in America. And I think anybody reading that chapter would get a huge laugh.
So you were excited when you learned that you were expecting a child, to have a daughter to be exposed to both English and American culture. What you hadn't bargained on was the fact that living there meant that you were raising a British child. You are an American with a British child.
Yes, I was so surprised. We moved to England before we started a family, and one of the reasons we did it is because we love New York, and we wouldn't have left, but we sort of thought we would be happier raising a child in London because London is a little bit greener and a little bit slower, and we could take our jobs there, and it was just, you know, since we could do it, we decided we wanted to try it. And when we had a family, I thought, oh, this is wonderful. I'm giving my child a cultural experience, because when I was a kid, the closest I ever got to an international experience was Epcot Center. And I'm not making that up. I didn't have a passport until I was 20 years old. But I desperately wanted one. It's all I ever wanted to do was travel. So I thought I was giving my child a cultural experience. But actually, it's not true at all. She feels completely British, and she doesn't have any sense of belonging to America. And this started to make me very sad and uncomfortable. So what I started to do was I would bring up America in conversation with her. She's now 4.5. So if we were doing something that had an American analog, or if I said a word that was different from what the British would say, now she's in school, she uses all those words, I would point out to her, well, this is the way Americans do it, or this is how we say it in America. And I thought that I might make her feel more American, but instead she started saying, oh, how do you do it in your country? Oh, mama, can you get this food in your country? And I ended up making myself seem more foreign to her rather than her feel more American.
Erin Moore's new book is called That's Not English: Britishisms, Americanisms, and What Our English Says About Us. Erin, it's been a delightful hour. Thank you so much for making the time.
Chris, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.